and it talked about research related to the number of hours a child spends on the screen time versus their mental health. And it was a little bit depressing, so I'm not going to tell you everything, but the study involved over 40,000 kids. And of the 40,000 kids, they found that young people who spend 7 hours or more a day on their screen are twice as likely to be diagnosed with depression or anxiety than those who spend an hour or less a day. And so they're really believing that the amount of screen time a child has is greatly influencing their mental health issues. They also found... What? Well, they actually have in for 4 hours. So it's not three, it's kind of that in between. And they say 4 hours also gives you an increased risk. Not double, but you're at an increased risk for the mental health disorders.
Okay, so
there, yeah, they did...
7 hours just seems like half your day.
You might be surprised how much kids spend. Because they'll spend it on their car rides, especially adolescents. And they found that this was more severe for adolescents than for children. And so, the children still exhibited mental health issues at a higher rate. But, sorry, pictures.
Are they having, computer?
Watching TV.
No, any screen, really?
They're counting screen time, not including school work.
Okay.
So they excluded school work. And they said 7 hours. And if you think about it, there are some kids who have access to their phones. I'm not saying y'all, because y'all are here, so obviously you care a little bit more. But what? Oh, it's yours. Okay. Thank you. But kids will get on first thing in the morning. And they've actually done studies, too, about people who check their phones first thing in the morning are far less productive than those who wait to check their phones. Because it lets your brain get online, helps you to make your own priorities, not from external influences, but from internal, and it starts your day differently. So it's a thing even for us adults. If the first thing you do is roll over and look at your phone, maybe you want to change that habit. I'm talking about parenting, sorry. And so they also talked about the increased risk of suicide for those and self-harm. So cutting. I know, I love little people. I wanted to hold it, but I don't think that's a good idea. So I say all that to say, and I'll pass this article around so y'all can look at it for yourself, but it's a little bit alarming, a little bit scary. So when Roxy was here talking about cell phones and making a contract for cell phones, it might be wise to expand it to screen time. And so I'll tell you, we noticed in our kids a big difference when they had screen time and when they didn't have screen time. And so the Spodey story goes like this. We had children, and every night we would let them pick one TV show to watch. So we would watch a Phineas and Ferb and a My Little Pony and a whatever. And then they would be so hard to put to bed because their brains got activated and wired on, and they were waking up as opposed to calming down. And they started to argue and fight and lie about their homework because they wanted to get to the TV. So we, as the Spodey family, said, no TV on school nights. And it was a rut. I know. Go ahead. Y'all go. Oh. So we have no electronics and no TV on school night unless it's directly related to school work. So we have a 13-year-old, and clearly she has to type papers and get on the Imagine Math or whatever it is and do stuff. But we don't turn on our TV during the week. And we have seen a profound difference in the way our children behave after school, the rate at which they do their homework independently, and the putting them to bed routines and waking up in the morning routines are very, very different. So that's just our household. And I was telling my Sunday school class, teaching some of the adults, that they asked how I got my kids to clean, because we have 4 bathrooms and 3 kids, so they each get a bathroom and we get a bathroom to clean, and they clean their rooms and do all that kind of stuff. The rule is, on Friday, we don't pull out the remote controls and the electronics until all the chores are done for the house. So they are actually in a hurry to get home and start cleaning. Dad, come to the living room. Help do this trash. We need to get our rooms done. We need to wipe down. They are pushing me to get all the house chores done. And so it's just been this complete flip in our house. And they're so looking forward to their TV time on the weekend that they'll do all kinds of things to get ready for it. You want to talk about that for a second? Is it crazy? Is it good? Is it? A couple of people are like, "Oh my God, what do I do with my child?"
How did you when you first transitioned to the no TV or electronics during the week? Was it just like a total backlash, and they just like?
So we put it on us, and we said we really feel like we've been spending too much time on our phones in the evening, and we would like to spend more time as a family. And so what we did, we were planning a Disney World trip at the time because we're Disney people, always going to Disney World. And so what we did was we said, we're going to unplug for a week. Mommy and Daddy and you, we're just going to all unplug. And so we picked a feature movie on Friday, which was Mary Poppins that week. And so we watched Mary Poppins. And that whole week we did activities related to Mary Poppins. So like we took the sidewalk chalk outside and did the sidewalk chalk. We made bird feeders out of toilet paper rolls and peanut butter and bird seed to feed the birds. And then we splashed in puddles and did whatever, right? So we just did activities every night that were related to our feature movie from the Friday before, because we're trying to prepare them for Disney World. And so it was a fun thing, not so much you're being punished because you suck as children, but more we need to do this more as a family and be in each other's space more. So there wasn't a huge, and after we did it for a week, they kind of got used to it. And they were younger, I acknowledge. Vivian was like, what, third grade maybe? Fourth grade? So it was younger, but it worked.
Sometimes electronics at our house just stop working, and we have the hardest time keeping them working. The router will go down, and the TV won't work right, and I don't know. Yeah. Sometimes the cables just come out. I don't know.
Yeah, it breaks.
Hard to say.
Any other comments or questions about that?
So on Saturday, are they like...
So we usually plan activities on Saturday. We have things that we do like, I know, what? Saturday's like our day to go do things. So sometimes we'll go, like, Zane sold coupon books for Cub Scouts this weekend, and then somebody else had a party at the park, and like we just, so they don't get unlimited time all weekend, and we do make them, anyway, so it's not unlimited, but it's a lot more. I mean, those, and Sunday we're at church till 2 o'clock. Right?
30 sometimes.
And before they can get back on TV on Sunday night, they have to have their whole week's worth of stuff prepared. So they'd have all their clothes out, all their socks out, all their shoes out, and we have like little cubbies for them to put them in. And so like they have things they have to do before they get back on TV Sunday night. And we cut it off early because we have to do our family devotion and take our baths and do all those kinds of things. So we're not hard-nosed like, you only get one TV show on Saturday, so they feel like they're getting all this TV, but we purposely fill their time. And sometimes we tell them no more TV. Like if they start fighting about it, the TV's gone. We don't, and there's one TV, so it makes life really great. Any other questions? Yes.
Yeah, so,
in the back.
Yes. Wait a minute. What about like the quality? And that's a bad word to say about TV, but like quality of the shows. Is there something that a rule that you have? Because like in our house, it's
yes.
TVS.
So,
Hallmark.
Yes.
Lifetime.
So, yes.
Only Lifetime.
We do. So, our rule is we have to watch it with them for the first time. And they can't watch new TV shows without our permission. So, anytime they want to watch a new movie or a new TV show, they have to have permission. And it's happened once or twice. They didn't ask permission, but it shows up, right? Because all of our TV, we don't have any TV channels. All we have is like Netflix and Hulu and Vudu and the things that where it tracks it. So the next time we log on, what do we see?
Continue watching.
Yes, continue watching. And so then I call my child in and I'm like, we specifically told you, Vivian did this one. Shh. Oh, yes.
Vivian.
She was being total terror. Anyway. And she was watching this TV show with this adolescent girl who was really disrespectful to all of her authority figures. And it was a cartoon-type show, but she was, like, internalizing it. And I was like, you cannot watch this anymore. You know what she did? She watched it more. And I was like, what is wrong with you? So, anyway, but it creates those conversations, too. So, yes, we have standards. And it's not just, like, by the code. It's by our children and where they're at and what their interests are. And we try to watch it together as a family first. Because if it's not appropriate for us to watch as a family, it's probably not okay. Now that we have a 13-year-old, Angela and Vivian will watch things together. So they'll do like mom and mother-daughter Smallville night or whatever. So we'll see. Anyway. Any other questions about that? Does it feel super extreme? Does it feel possible? Does it feel impossible?
It feels extreme, but I admire that you do it. I mean, it's awesome. But how do you find the energy during the week to do activities?
So sometimes I'm doing chores, and if my children are bored, they join me in the chores. Uh-huh. Or they go outside and they play things. So you have the choice. You can go outside and play, or you can help me with my chores. All of a sudden, they get real busy outside. Funniest thing.
I think some of it is how you treat boredom.
Yeah.
So whenever our kids are like, "Daddy, I'm bored," I'm like, "That's terrific. Look at you. You have so much opportunity now to create something interesting."
Well, see, when they say bored to us, they start getting chores.
Oh, yeah.
That's code word for you get chores.
Because sometimes our kids are like, "Can we do the screen thing?" And we don't have like hard and fast rules.
Yeah.
But we're pretty controlling about screen time. And we just see that as opportunity.
Yeah.
Like, that's...
And we try to model it for them. I'm not sitting in the chair on my phone all afternoon playing my games. Every once in a while I do have work, but that's a work thing. And they'll come up and be like, "Dad, are you on your phone?" And I'm like, "I'm looking at my email." And they're like, "Oh, okay." And they walk off. Like, because I remind them, I work 40 plus 60 something hours a week. So I do it while they're in bed and while they're in school mostly. But in the afternoons I try to be there with them and present with them. And it's funny the conversations you have with your children when you're present. So,
I think, remember too, like, all of it has to make your life
easier.
If it makes your life harder, it's not sustainable.
No.
And the most important thing is to be consistent in whatever you do.
And I'm not saying this is the standard for everybody. I'm just saying this is what we got to. And it's actually worked pretty well for us.
Because when they're little, like, you're training them on the things that they're going to do when they're older.
Yeah.
So if the goal is older, we want to have manageable screen time.
Yes.
These are the things that
you can do. And it's been interesting. Vivian got a Chromebook for Christmas. And so that changed her whole world because now she has her own computer. And so it's created some more discussions about, well, can I do this? Can I do that? And when is this appropriate? When is this not appropriate? And what we've done is we've asked her what she thinks is appropriate and when, and to present it to us. And then we have the conversation. So we're not starting with us telling her what she has to do. We ask her what seems reasonable to her. And so that gives her the responsibility. So.
I find once they get out of the habit of it, it's not their default anymore.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And like, if it's out of sight, it's out of mind.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's true. They don't ask. They don't go up. They don't sneak it. They don't.
Our kids were gifted Amazon tablets years ago, and they literally, they'll just disappear.
Yeah.
And they forget about them. You know what I mean? Because they've gotten used to not defaulting to it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the same thing. If it's there. You know,
yeah. And all of our electronics that are portable live in the study. That's where their charging cords are, and that's where everything has to be turned back into. So if it's an iPad or a computer or whatever, they don't get to keep it in their room. They have to keep it out in the public area. So, okay. So, anyway, it's just scary how screen time affects kids' brains. Okay, next let's talk depression. Do you want to talk depression? Yay, depression's so great. So depression is on the rise. Surprise, surprise. They said some of the research that I've read indicated that depression and suicide, they put the two together, have doubled in being coded at hospitals, like ERs, since, I'll say like 2005 to 2015. So over that 10-year period, the coding for those people coming in for either suicide or depression or some kind of like major mental health has doubled. And that's just what they've tracked. And they think that a lot of people don't get help when they need help. They get embarrassed or don't know what to do and don't realize that emergency rooms can also help with mental health issues. And so one of the scary things is if you have a child who ends up with mental health issues, you don't know what to do. And so before we talk about depression as a whole, what would you do if you found your child was suicidal? What would you do if you found your kid cutting? What would you do if you thought your kid was depressed? That is a question.
I'd probably ask pediatrician.
Yes.
Maybe from the weekend or Friday night. Or
yeah, it always happens Friday night about 2 a.m.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll call you. You call me. So that's it. We're just going to ask the pediatrician.
I would want to know, so like a lot, most suicide happens for at least two, usually three reasons. One, people feel like they're a burden to someone.
Mm-hmm.
Two, they feel like they don't really belong. Like there's a sense of not belonging.
Disconnect, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, in the literature, it's called perceived burdensomeness
mm-hmm.
and thwarted belongingness.
Mm-hmm.
But then in that state of not really having a community, not really belonging, and a feeling like you're a burden, then you also feel eventually like those conditions won't change, which
mm-hmm.
is how depression and hopelessness sinks in, because you think this is always going to be the case, so what really is the point of your life being there? So if I found our kids that way, I think I'd take them out for ice cream
mm-hmm.
and make sure that I kept my phone in the car,
mm-hmm.
but I brought out my credit cards because I keep them together.
Yeah.
So I could pay, you know, because you wouldn't want to steal ice cream from your kids. Like.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, but like to figure out how to listen to your kids more.
Mm-hmm.
And then figure out where they feel like they're not belonging. I mean, you can't, you have to have rapport with your kids before that even comes up. And you, I think you have to kind of pave the way to be able to talk about those things. So we don't talk about suicide, but we do talk about connection and loneliness and that sort of stuff with our kids. But so when those things come up, you have some pathway, like some connection with your kids to for that information, emotional or kind of cognitive, to be passed, and then to figure out ways to help them connect.
Mm-hmm.
And because I think so much about depression and certainly so much about suicide, other kind of escapist behaviors like drug use, it's all about not belonging or being a burden to someone.
So
I think that's where I used to be. As a parent, like, if I could just get my kids to feel like they belong and they, you know, and there is a very strong thing. I will say I've had experiences in my life that fall more into the mental illness
mm-hmm.
category that are an illness that have nothing to do with that. And I think as a parent, the one thing I wished I had a better radar for were those things that are out of control. Like the fact that there are medicines out there
mm-hmm.
that if your kid took
mm-hmm.
that, or a chemical level in their system that could make them want to kill themselves, independent of anything else, right?
Mm-hmm.
That just terrifies. Like that is, so how to recognize that versus, oh, my kid's feeling a little down, my kid's being bullied or being picked up, which are all also very important things, but the help, like the threat, if I confuse those,
yeah,
I think it's a very different thing.
I think that's why you have to be in a position to listen to your kid. So you can really be the expert on what's going on with your kid. And you can see, yeah, there's chemical imbalances and stuff that happens that drives a lot of depression and
yeah.
other
well,
stuff.
And
but you have to know. Like,
my default was to go to that first,
uh-huh.
was to be like, oh, it must be something. I just need to give more love.
Okay.
Or I just need to do this.
So a couple more people. You had your and then you.
So the question was, if you found out your child was suicidal
mm-hmm.
or was cutting, it is an immediate emergency.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if somebody is right there having a heart attack.
Yeah.
That's my opinion. Actually, had a friend, we were going into our middle school party on Friday, and she got a call that her son took her life.
Mm-hmm.
And, It's and this is the second friend in high school.
Yeah.
This year.
Yes.
Same community. And
let me just throw in the statistics. So suicide overall in the U.S. is the 8th highest cause of death, and for children ages 15 to 24, it's the 2nd highest cause of death.
Boys, 18-year-old,
mm-hmm.
like
per
category.
Yep.
And
so it's a thing that's happening.
The number one thing that I've learned is that signs showed up less than a month.
Mm-hmm.
The event took place, and that they've also shown that these kids think about it for about 5 minutes before they act on it.
Yeah.
It is not a over time. It is think about how short our span of time was when we were teenagers. Like, it was, like, just so narrow and so short. And unfortunately, and not to be critical of the people that I know that experienced this, but I don't think you realize, yes, your child is capable of it, and that it is literally an emergency. And it's okay to, like, treat it as an emergency, because it's a matter of life and death.
Yes.
And, like, immediately seek.
Yeah. You can call 911 or go to an emergency room immediately.
And it's okay. And so it's kind of like, I think...
And they will help you assess the lethality of your child.
Right. My initial would have been, without going through these experiences, would have been more like, love, let's be, you know. And now seeing, having experienced it just this week, is be overreactive. And then after you have the professional immediate emergency help, let it settle, and then kind of work backwards and see, okay, now we're going to address this, now, and then get to the point where you can.
And a lot of schools are equipped to do an initial assessment for suicidality. And in fact, in the Texas Administrative Code, it actually lists that every campus has to have a school counselor that can assess suicidality in children. A lot of them like to pawn it off because it's a little bit scary onto LSSPs, licensed specialists in school psychology. But every school district has some kind of protocol. And our protocol in the district I worked in, it was very clear. We asked a set of questions, and it was an interview type thing. And at the end, we were able to tell whether a child was low, moderate, or severe. And it's not always perfect because it's self-report, but we had a pretty good idea of where the child was. And the biggest obstacle usually was the parents. Parents are in denial that their child can be in that state, but it's happening more and more.
I was just going to say,
thank you for sharing that.
A third party, get a counselor, get somebody, because parents aren't always, in fact, most times with kids that age, they're just having that. The parent isn't the one that they want to talk to. They need somebody who's not, they don't feel judged by.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
I think kids are like cats. Like, they're not going to show that they're sick or vulnerable until they can't hide it anymore. So their parents are going to be the last to know, because they're good at putting up a front to parents. So I think maybe they just recognized, hey, there are these other outside people.
And it's twofold.
And other adults.
Yeah, sometimes kids are trying to avoid dealing with their parents on something that's so emotional. And the other times they care so much about their parents, they want to drag them into their hurt. And so I have this other article about a teenager who was depression anxious and started cutting. And she was 17 when she started cutting, and it was a momentary escape for all the stress that was in her life and the anxiety she was feeling. And one of the things that I thought was interesting, it says it would be 3 years before Faith Ann, now 20 and a student in college, told her parents about the depths of her distress. She hid the marks, the cutting marks, on her arms and torso, and hid the sadness she couldn't explain and didn't feel was justified. On paper, she had a good life. She loved her parents and knew they'd be supportive if she asked for help. She just couldn't bear seeing the worry on their face. So she kept it in. And so I think having the conversations and having that open communication is important. But to realize that a lot of mental health goes really deep, and there's a whole spectrum of treatment for mental health issues. It's not one thing is the right thing. And that's kind of like with the technology. You don't have to have the Spodey method in your house, right? You can do something totally different, and it's okay. It's your house. But the same is true with mental health. There's the spectrum of, like, medication, counseling, trying to do things that are natural boosters for all kinds of reasons, right? So if a child gets more sunlight, right, they feel a little bit happier. They actually did a study that if a child gets sunlight for 15 minutes in the morning, like at 11 o'clock, and 15 minutes in the afternoon at 2 o'clock, they have an increase in their mood, which is a thing. Just 30 minutes of sunlight, taking your vitamins, taking melatonin at night so they can sleep, like real basic things might make a difference. The other thing that I found is, in my own private practice, when I work with people, if I find out there's anything related to sleep, I send them away for a sleep study. Because if you're not resting well, it affects your mental health. And I think a lot of our teenagers and children are not resting well. And so just some basic things that can be preventative and helpful will affect some of these mental disorders from onset and becoming more severe. Does that make sense? And I have about 33% that come back and say, you were right. It's that I wasn't sleeping and resting well. And so they don't need counseling. They need to figure out how to get better rest. So I save people thousands of dollars and work myself out of a job.
Lauren just called me naive. And I wanted to put it to the test.
Oh, good. I'm going to pass around the article about the cutter.
I asked her if she thought it was naive of me to think that my kids would be knowable by me when they're in middle school and high school. And she told me that she thought I was naive for thinking that. And I was just curious about more seasoned parents to know your opinion. Do you think
about when you were a kid? I mean, you were standing up for all of that stuff, right? That your parents...
It's slightly different relationship.
Slightly different.
What do you think by knowable?
Like...
Yeah.
I think just how, you can't really put a percentage on it.
Yes.
I would, so if I would know like 70% of my kids.
About them?
Yeah, no, like if I would know if they're, like, if they have a depressed affect or if they, what their social environment is like. How connected they are with what the quality of those relationships are, and
I mean, it can be 95 that you know. It's the 5% that that, and I would say take your breath away.
One of the speakers that we had coming, I don't remember which one it was, a year ago in the fall, said something that I thought was so profound. They said, you know, whoever is the lower authority, whoever doesn't have power, always knows the people in power better than vice versa, right? Because they are the ones that have to work. So my children have to work at knowing me almost better than I know them to make the things happen that they want to have happen, right? All I have to do is say, go make your bed, theoretically, and they will go make their bed.
It's like, really? That's all it takes?
Right? Like, y'all get what I'm saying. Like, I can't remember all the words, but like the person without the power, when your boss, you know how to work the system with your boss, you know your boss because you have to. They don't have to because they have the power. And so they just talked about how your children can know you in ways to manipulate and do abandon, like just to get what they need, right? And so I think that structure in and of itself will sometimes put them at an advantage to know how, like this girl in this example, and like our girls have done that before, like, we don't want you to know, not because we're being disobedient or whatever, because we don't want you to know, like, because we're going to hurt you or we're going to this or we're going to that. So I just thought that was so interesting when they said that, to think about how do our children know us in ways and how can they use that, or how do they use that to make things happen. So by definition, we're not going to know everything, like, they're not 100%.
And I think on the flip side, it's kind of a faith walk with your children. I pray all the time that the Holy Spirit will give the right moment in time, because with children, they're not ready to talk when you're ready to talk. It's like, I remember Vivian, 11 years old, I'm dropped off the littles and we're going to school and there's this short car ride between the campuses and she's like, Daddy, I like a boy. And I was like, oh my God, keep driving, don't freak out, don't spaz. I was like, tell me more about that. Right? Then she just goes off. And, of course, I waited about 3 or 4 days, and I took her lunch. I was like, which boy is it? I didn't bring her lunch that day, but as quick as I could get there, I got there. And it was just one of those moments where she just opened up and wanted to talk, and it was just that fast, and it was gone. And I think that my prayer has always been that God will make me ready for those moments when they are ready to talk. Because we do this thing like where we'll take them on dates and we'll go eat snow cones and play games and spend 4 hours at the park and nothing comes out, right?
You're on your way to go pee.
Yes. That's exactly. When you might not even hear it. Anyway, and so it's like that 30 seconds in the car between the two campuses. I'm like, okay, this is the moment where she's telling me about all this stuff and she's opening up and she's testing to see what it's going to be like and can she trust me. And so... some of it, I don't want to say it's chance, because I believe God's in control of all things, but I think that it's us being in tune with the Spirit and asking the Spirit to make our children in tune, that we will be ready to receive when they are ready to give. And you don't get to plan it. So I took her, in fact, like 2 months before that, I took her to the Melting Pot, and we were talking, and she had a crush on the boy that long ago. But she didn't talk about it on our father-daughter date to the Melting Pot where we ate four courses. Yeah. Whatever. It would have been great. We had 4 hours to talk about. She wanted the 30 seconds. I know exactly what she wanted. Anyway, so I think that's part of it too, is our faith ties into how we parent and how we deal with mental illness too.
What did you end up sharing with your wife?
Not very much. I don't want to tell all my stories. But there's plenty. It's been interesting, the development of mine and my daughter's relationship, because her mom's an attorney. And so when she was like 2 years old, I had her all summer to myself because mom was studying for the bar exam, right? And that's like a whole day thing, and mommy's just not here. And so we did all kinds of stuff together. And so we've always kind of had a bond. And it's just developed over the years where things have happened where I've had to step in and do things that traditionally the mom would do, but I had to do because my wife wasn't available for whatever reason. So, like, she came home from PE one day. She's like, "Dad, I need some support." And I'm like, "I can give you support." She's like, "No, I need some support." And I was like, "Oh, no. No, no. I'm not ready for this." So we went to the store, and I found the nice old lady. I was like, "We need help." So we did that, Angela was here, she was at work, and it was between picking up the little kids and whatever, and then her first period, right? Mom was out of town at a conference. She's like, "Oh yes, oh yes." And so she's like, "Dad, I need stuff." And I'm like, "What do you mean you need stuff?" And so we get there, we're in Target, and she's like, "Which is what?" I said, "Just buy one of everyone. Wrap it up and go home." Right? So over the years, maybe my prayer was too much. I don't know. Because I've just had these moments with her that we've gone through all of these things. And so now she trusts me. But her and her mother have been very deliberate about building a deeper relationship through other things. So it's not an either-or thing. It's just, why couldn't I be the one that goes and runs and exercises with her at 6 a.m. and does this stuff? Why do I have to be the one that deals with support issues? So, yes.
Do I have questions for JT?
Yes.
Is there any...
I'm going to pass around to See My Pain. It's a cutting book. It's really good.
Sorry. In your research or what in your practice, do you see any sort of shift of people trying to not wait until there's a crisis? Like, let's get our kids into the therapy when there's not a problem so they become accustomed to getting help, like mental health, so we prevent some of this. That's something I've been playing around with. I've currently got my children going to therapy, not because there's a crisis, because I've tried to relate it to the pediatrician. Like, when you go to the doctor every year on your birthday to make sure your body's okay, we're going to go to a therapist to talk to someone that's not mom and dad just to get a mental health check. And you can go as many times as you want. Like, we can once a year, once a month, whatever. Is that, am I on a lone island thinking that's the way to go? Or is there any sort of research to show that don't wait till there's a problem, kind of build in this normalization of mental health?
I think that that's what they've tried to do with putting counselors and psychologists in the school. But it's not worked out very well because they pull them to do all kinds of administrative things.
Right.
And I think that, you know, counseling runs a whole spectrum. There are people who are severely mentally ill and have to be hospitalized and can't make their own choices. And then there are people that are high functioning that just have bumps in the road and need support. And so it's for a wide spectrum of people. And my philosophy has been, like, for my family and my kids is, you know, we have a path that we want to be on, mental health speaking. And when we get 1 foot off, it's real easy to get back on the path. It just takes one step and we're back on the path. But if we wait and we get further and further apart, it takes a lot of work to get back where we want to be. So prevention or early intervention has been proven to make a big difference. But I don't know that it's totally there's nothing going on. Usually there's something.
There's always something.
Right. So it's, you don't just take them to be like, "Hey, my kid's perfect. Will you talk to him for an hour?" There's usually some kind of
cutting,
symptom.
Like,
right.
Children aren't cutting, but like there's issues that, you know, I can't solve. Like,
yes.
We're like, you know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely. And family therapy is really good.
Yeah.
We had some trouble with one of our children, and we were doing therapy for that child, and then we did group therapy, and we did some family therapy sessions, and it was really enlightening. They did a lot of play therapy and art therapy with us, and we did this one activity where we created this fish tank, and we all had to create our own animals that went in the fish tank, and we had to place ourselves in the tank, and how big we were, and where we were located, and all these things, like, talked a lot about how our relationships were as a family, and it was really eye-opening, so...
On the other hand, I've also been reading a lot about resilience and grit,
mm-hmm.
those two new words.
Yes.
So at what point do I just look at my child, you know, like middle school and high school, and I'm like, you just need to buck up a little bit and
mm-hmm.
get some resilience on you?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
Or do I just, you know, like the other day, my husband said, should we go do some therapy? I'm like, no, because middle school's just hard.
Yeah.
I mean, or is it? I mean, like...
No. So there's a really great TED Talk about grit. If you haven't seen the TED Talk, it's worth watching. And I think that the big difference for me is when it starts to impact their day-to-day functioning.
Okay.
So, like, if it's something like it's a bump in the road and they have a bad day, mm-hmm. we all have bad days. But if it's something that seems to persist over a longer period of time or seems to be reoccurring in some way
okay.
or is affecting something like schoolwork, socialization, family relationships on a more moderate level,
mm-hmm.
that's when I think it's more helpful. And so it has to be...
therapy are not like
exclusive
opposite
yeah.
things, right? I mean, mm-hmm. if you're going to get therapy, that takes grit to go through it, right? I
yes.
mean,
well, but for some kids, it feels like the stigma.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really on the therapist to set up the relationship correctly.
Mm-hmm.
That this is about, usually what I say is I'm here to help build your support systems.
Yeah.
Like, you have what you need. My philosophy in counseling is I want to help you get to the healthiest place you can get to, either more quickly than you would get there on your own or to a healthier place than you would get on your own. And I'm just joining this journey with you. But it's your journey. And you get to leave anytime you want and come anytime you want. But I just want to walk along beside you and help you. So
you're giving him the confidence to have grit.
Yeah.
But I don't want to go to a therapist every time you have a bad day.
No, right. It's not a bad... So I think when it starts affecting their ability to... their day-to-day functioning... And when we talk about the DSM and diagnosing, there's a clinical judgment that has to be made. And that's part of what we get trained for in all our 60 hours of master's degree or doctorate or whatever it is how to determine when it's clinically significant. So sometimes it's hard to know. But that's usually where a pediatrician has a screening tool. I'm looking at my pediatrician. All pediatricians that I've ever worked with have a screening tool. And they will screen and say, hey, it might be worth going to get some extra help because you check off this many things. And they're able to discuss with you whether it's clinically significant enough to seek help or not. And that's part of your normal routine. That's not adding an extra person in. And they usually have a referral list that they have a general sense about.
I'm a big fan of talking to your pediatrician about that.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's how we ended up putting my child... in therapy, because we were looking at the checklist, and about the third year, our checklist was a little bit high. We were like, maybe this is more than I think it is. And so that's when we went. It was our pediatrician's checklist that really kind of triggered it for us. So.
I also just want to throw out there, if you think that you're in a moment of crisis, and you're wondering, like, do we need to go to the emergency room or not, there is a free helpline in every county around here, and you just Google, like, Harris County
Yes.
Because the number one predictor of suicide is access to a gun.
That's true. And with the onset of telemedicine, a lot of you have zero copay teledoctors that you can talk to. So you can actually talk to a physician. And there's a really good website. It's called TexasSuicidePrevention.org. And it has all kinds of, like, training and resources, not just about suicide, but about mental health as a whole. Because a lot of these things are comorbid, meaning they occur at the same time. It's not like someone's just depressed. Like, the vast majority of people who deal with mental illness deal with more than one. They're not just isolated. Yeah?
I want to say this about counseling and best therapy helps you identify your own resources and access them both internally, like self-beliefs and self-talk type stuff, and external, like in your peer environment, in your family environment, activities that help you cope with that. So a lot of good therapy is just elevating for your awareness, improving your own self, your self-awareness, your self-intelligence, to give you more coping skills later. So if you, I mean, for that situation and for similar situations in the future, so if you, if your concern is you don't want to take your kid because bad things happen, if your kid is not fully aware of all the resources available to them to cope with bad days, then like a couple, one or a couple of shots at a therapy session to help elevate their own awareness might give them capacity to deal with those future bad days that are surely going to come. But I think a big key is just how aware your kids are of what they have available to cope with.
And I like having a therapist that our family's already connected with. So if things happen later on. Two more articles about the signs of anxiety and depression I'll just pass around. And do you have any questions for me? I'm sorry. I could talk all night about all this.
There was one thing you brought up about, it's not really a question. Sorry.
It's okay.
There is an aspect of suicide with kids that I don't think was really touched on.
Yeah. This was a very surface touch on all of this. So.
There's, no, and you did an excellent job.
Yeah.
By all means, that's not a criticism to you.
No.
But there's an aspect of it where, you know, anxiety, which usually is coupled with depression, is just so big right now.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time, you find those in high achievers.
Yes.
The anxiety. And the kids that score well, that do well, that are involved, that, you know, they are not the quiet ones in the corner that kind of are socially awkward.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the ones that turn to suicide or turn to cutting because they are just so tired of fighting that
feeling,
anxiety,
yeah,
and that overwhelming feeling of never being able to meet their standards. And they may be meeting standards that you never would have expected them.
Yes.
It's internal. And so those are the ones that are just the emergency situations that, because it'll happen out of nowhere, the ones that you're not expecting. And I suffer bad from anxiety. And I remember a doctor telling me, because I would feel moments of just wanting to escape that, just because I'm tired of battling it. As a kid, my dad was like, well, I get anxiety all the time because work is hard, and, you know, you just need to take some deep breaths, and not taking it seriously that it needed help.
Yeah.
And I had a doctor tell me, why are you exhausting yourself? Like, that is why we have medication. Like,
yeah.
Like, you shouldn't have to work this hard to function.
Yeah.
And I'm not medicated all the time. You know, I have seasons in my life that it's totally great.
Yeah.
Totally fine. And then all of a sudden it's like,
yeah,
let's go back on it. And I think you were saying knowing your kids, like being aware of them, despite the fact that they don't communicate that to you.
Yes.
And being really good friends with their friends' parents, because that's how I find out that he's got a girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
Or that everybody hung out at this house and this went on because it's all this community. And we were going to move not too long ago, and I told my husband, I was like, we have to make this work because I've built this community for 10 years.
Right.
And we have a teenager now, and this is my safety net to find out things that he won't directly tell me about, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that nobody won't know your child.
And
as long
it's,
as you'd like to, but that's why you have.
It's just way more rampant than you know.
It is.
Like, I was a new school counselor, like 2002, 2003, and I got a report that a kid was cutting. So I brought the kid in and talked to him about cutting and did all the things I was supposed to do. And I just happened to ask this question. I was like, do you know anyone else who's cutting? And so she gave me three or four more names. And then by the end of asking all those kids, do you know someone else? I saw over 30 children in 1 week in sixth grade who were cutters. And that was back 15 years ago. And it's just because I asked the simple question, like, do you know anyone else who's doing this? And I don't know why. Holy Spirit. They just said, oh, yeah. I was like, no, stop. By the end, I did not want to ask the question anymore. Yeah. But I just felt like I had to. So it's just, it's way more than you think. And some of them were, like, really at the beginning stage, kind of toying with it. And some of them were way more into it and had their ritual and their cutting kits and all that kind of stuff. Like, it's, there's a whole spectrum with it.
Cutting kit?
Yeah, it's, anyway, I'm way past time.
It's the purse pack. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's like a little purse pack that yeah. some of the girls will carry around them that they can take care
boys,
of.
Boys, too, they have, it's usually like a razor blade, some kind of cleaning supply, some kind of like disinfectant. Like it's a thing that they have. But because it's part, and it's very ritualistic for them.
Definitely.
And the physical pain releases them from their emotional pain temporarily. And so it's like taking their pain that's on the inside and bringing it out so that they can feel it.
See, I think about touching ice. I saw like a news report recently about there's a study that for people who, or for adolescents who engage in self-harming behaviors, touching ice gives them a temporary shock and breaks them out of a cognitive pattern that they're trying to get out of when they're cutting.
I've not seen that.
I didn't read much into it, but it comes to mind now.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry. Thank you.